Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. That's Thin Lizzy there and Downtown Sundown from the album Bad Reputation. And I'm playing that track because my guest tonight on this Sunday Night Mystery Train, where we get someone to pick the music, is the Emmy Award winning director and filmmaker Emer Reynolds, who is currently working on a documentary film, if that's the correct title of it, about Philip. So, Emer, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much.
Now, full disclosure here is that we met relatively recently when you asked me to contribute to your film. And while we were talking, I thought, I must ask Emer Reynolds to contribute to my Sunday night programme because we're both Thin Lizzy fans.
So the tables are turned tonight?
Yeah, both Lizzy fans. But I think what was interesting for me was that you like the kind of Lizzy that I like, which is that softer, gentler side to Lizzy that some people don't know about.
Yeah, it's very interesting. People associate him with the big, blousy, noisy, sexy guitars and the full frontal performance. But there's this whole other side to him, this softer, poetic, emotional side that absolutely our film is hoping to explore.
Now, we'll talk about that as time goes on. I'm sure Lizzy are on your list. But I want to find out during the course of this programme how you get to do what you do, to be a documentary filmmaker. Is that the title that you are happy with, documentary filmmaker? And director and editor and all the rest of it, yeah.
At the moment, this is my third feature documentary to direct. So I'm directing documentaries, but I'm also developing drama features for my future. So, yeah.
And we need to talk about the Emmy. And I want to talk in particular about The Farthest, which was about the Voyager gold record, something I was always interested in. So it's great there's a film about that as well. So, Emer, just your first choice is a well-known tune, a well-known piano tune to anybody who ever had a piano in their house. So where did you hear it first? On the movie or where?
No, this is a memory straight out of my very youngest childhood. We had a piano in our living room, and piano's always been a massive influence, and I have a massive emotional response to a piano. And I believe it's my mother, who died unfortunately when we were very young, was a great pianist and used to play the piano and throw open the windows of the living room, and all the children would dance in, from the road would kind of gather in the garden. But I have no memory of that. What I do remember is my Uncle Paddy, who was my father's brother, was a fabulous pianist, and he used to come and play the piano in our house and always played this song, and me and my sisters would dance around the house to it, and I really love it.
Haven't heard this in years. Well, there you go. Marvin Hamlisch on piano there from the soundtrack, the movie The Sting. The first choice tonight of the director, Emer Reynolds, who's my guest tonight. So Emer, you were talking about hearing that piano music when you were a kid, your Uncle Paddy. So where was home?
Well, home was pretty much Dublin. I was born and went to school in Dublin in Raheny, and lived there with my dad and my three sisters. But we also had a kind of a dual life, a split life, because my mother, as I said, had died when we were very small. Anytime we weren't in school, we basically spent all our time down on my aunt and uncle's farm in southern Tipperary near Mullinahone. So I kind of had the two lives. I had this totally urban, working class Dublin life with, all that goes with that, gangs on the street and playing on the road and having a laugh with kids around my road. And then this other life I'd have all summer long and Easter holidays and Christmas holidays, where we lived on this massive dairy farm in the middle of the Golden Vale, and we were like feral children wandering the...
Did you enjoy all of that part of it, being the feral child?
Yeah, I really loved it. I was just thinking about it when I was driving in, and after milking the cows and having a bit of breakfast, we'd just go down to the fields wandering around. My aunt wouldn't know where we were, and we'd come back when we got hungry, and she'd sometimes have to hose us down. We'd be so dirty, and then we'd just head off again. So it was very, very free, very open, wild, really.
And you're probably asleep before it got dark, and you slept properly.
Exactly.
Probably the last time in your life you ever did sleep properly.
Exactly.
I know. I could do with a session of that. Is that farm still there?
Yeah.
Good time. And your musical interests. At what point do you think you started to get a kind of a connection with what was on the radio or on television, or where did you hear it?
Yeah, I guess I think in our house, certainly in our house in Ruhini, I don't remember any music particularly in Mullinahone, in that farm. And maybe that was because, as you say, we were all just so conked out and exhausted, we couldn't even lift up the vinyl record to put it on. I do remember, though, when I was down there, it was Elvis died one of the nights I was down there. And I do remember my uncle sitting on the stairs and crying, you know.
Really? Yeah.
So obviously Elvis was in my mind. In our house in Ruhini, it was all a bit improvised. You know, my Uncle Paddy on the piano, the woman, Mrs. Curry, who basically looked after us, she was in a ladies group and she used to sing kind of South Pacific and, you know, Fiddler on the Roof, those kind of songs. My dad played the recorder, but we didn't have a record player or anything. So it was all a bit, as I say, improvised and homespun for a while. My earliest memories of starting to be aware of music are... I started to like Neil Young. I don't really know why. You know, I don't know if it got introduced to me or if it just kind of bubbled into my consciousness.
But surely before Neil Young, there was, I don't know, the Bay City Rollers or something.
Oh yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Gosh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we had the socks with the tartan down the side.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, the reason I asked that is I can see your number two choice, kind of from that period where kids really get into music before they're old enough to get into something that they think is really cool. But before that, there's that innocent period where you just like something that's on top of the pops.
This song is particularly, it's actually directed at my dad, who we sang it all the time to him, probably drove him mad. Anywhere we were driving, the four kids would just be singing it at the top of our lungs because he was mother and father to us and was an extraordinary, loving, bright, generous, wonderful man, and you know, gave us his whole life. And so we sang this 24 hours a day just to make him feel good.
Well, you probably didn't see that coming. That's Boney M and Daddy Cool, the second choice of Emma Reynolds, the Emmy Award winning director and film editor, who's with me tonight picking the tracks. Do you know, someone else, I think it was Wendy Erskine, picked Boney M as well. If you are of a certain age, Boney M could well have been one of those first bands to make an impact on you at all, because at least they were a spectacle.
Yeah.
And you know, if you're a kid, that was music for dancing to.
And when you think about what it was like in the 70s, like Top of the Pops was this weekly, you know, you sat down at 10 to 7 so that you'd be ready in front of the telly when it started. And it defined your experience for the entire week. I remember seeing them playing Rasputin on Top of the Pops and nearly losing my mind, you know, that you could sing a song about that and dance about it on Top of the Pops.
And what's also kind of interesting, you know, about music is, you know, that song has an emotional charge for you because you talked about your dad before you played that, you know, so it's Daddy Cool. It actually means something.
Yeah.
You know, you'd imagine if you're picking a tune, you know, that reminds you of your father, it might be something that he sang or something more, inverted commas, substantial.
Well, I was going
than a
to
Boney
choose,
M track.
I was going to choose Neil Sedaka, last song together, but I thought I might end up in tears and then we wouldn't be able to continue.
No, but it's interesting, isn't it, that a song like that, like a throwaway pop song, let's put it that way, like Daddy Cool, could have real depth of meaning for someone.
Yeah, and you know, as recently as 3 or 4 weeks ago at my nephew's 21st, myself and my sisters were dancing to it and you know, celebrating a man who's dead over 30 years and his influence on his daughters and on you know, the generations going forward. So yeah, you're absolutely right. The pop, the music, even pop music or even pop candy, kind of throwaway pop music can reach forward into the future like that.
And it works brilliantly in movies, doesn't it, sometimes, you know? David Lynch is a master of that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, some corny pop song from the 50s becomes deeply threatening and
absolutely. And you
whatever.
See it through a completely new lens.
Blue Velvet, for instance, would be one. Now, the family you're talking, it wasn't all, was it all girls?
Yes, yeah.
And you're a twin as well?
Yeah, my three girls and we're in the middle, me and my twin.
Was there anything, Emer, about your family upbringing in the house? You know, it wasn't in a particularly musical house, but there was music there. But was there anything in the house that might have led you to this career that you're in now? Was there a big appreciation of the movies? Did you sit down on a Friday night to watch the late movie or anything like that?
No, absolutely not. In fact, there was very little of it. There was very little TV in the house. My dad was we used to do kind of maths and physics puzzles just for fun and, you know, spelling competitions. And it was all about, you know, he was I come from a long line of pedants, you know, so there was a rule about having a dictionary by your bed if you were reading something you didn't understand a word. And so we were very interested in, I don't think movies was part of the conversation at all. In fact, the first film I went to see was when I was 12. I went to see Star Wars in this, what was the Savoy One, which is no longer the big cinema it used to be. But so I hadn't actually been to the cinema until that point, you know. But
now I want to ask you about Star Wars in a minute. But what you said there about doing maths and physics puzzles and all the rest of it, was it a highly academic kind of situation, or was this just self improvement?
It was playfulness. My dad,
really, yeah?
Yeah, my dad had left school too young. His own father had died when he was 15, and he had to leave school and become, the breadwinner for his family. So he was extremely smart and well read. He had a whole wall of Reader's Digest in the house. You know, loved reading and just loved crosswords and was very interested in. So it was all, I think it came out of just joy. You know, we used to play. We were all very interested in maths. We were all very good at maths. Kit got that from him. And if we were driving anywhere, we'd drive down to Tipperary. He would make us do endless calculations as to what time we would get there and what speed and how much petrol we'd burn. And, you know, so it was just, it was playful. And
doesn't sound like fun to me.
It was, yeah, to us. And in fact, I still see science, as you see from The Farthest, which is about space and science, an absolute joy in space, in science, in pure learning, just in experimentation and not being afraid of being wrong and not being afraid of not understanding, you know, just being.
And was the intent that you would have all got the education that he didn't get? Was that a big part of his motivation, do you
think? Yeah, although, you know, his catchphrase now, which is a wonderful catchphrase, he was very keen on just do your best, you know. So the four of us had varying skills. We were good at different things. And his view was just as long as you're doing your best and you're trying, that was good enough. So it wasn't even that we had to achieve academically or, you know, that he was standing there ready to correct your homework or anything. You know, it was just a feeling of that there was value in all of this.
And what were you good at?
I was certainly good at maths. All four of us were good at maths. I think that was just a genetic thing. But I was also, you know, which is something certainly in girls' schools in the 70s and 80s, they weren't quite able for. I was good at maths and I was good at English. It seemed to be in my school, you were either into the humanities or the sciences.
Yeah, yeah.
And they didn't know what to do with you if you liked both. So I liked both. And, you know, when I left school and I studied maths and physics in university, people used to say to me, friends used to say to me, I'm amazed you're studying maths. I thought you were quite creative. And I think maths is really, really creative, you know. So I never saw the difference in those ideas, you know, that physics and maths and English and history, that they're all the same.
Yeah. Mm. And all right, there's plenty to talk about there. There's lots to talk about, but let's play another track because I don't want to get too far out of your childhood. You mentioned earlier on being in Tipperary when Elvis died, and you've chosen an Elvis track. You mentioned your uncle crying, but do you remember how you reacted?
Yeah, I mean, I love Elvis now, and I love Elvis to this day. So I don't recall crying, but I do remember the feeling in the house of, you know, the shock of this massive icon dying. And I have very few memories of that time, but him sitting on the stairs sobbing is, you know. And I told his son, my cousin, that recently, and he didn't recall that at all. So it's funny how certain memories will drip into one child's mind and not into another. But this particular Elvis song, this is my favorite Elvis song, and it's pretty unwell known. Is that a word? Well, let's go with that.
It is now. It is now. Yeah, I'm leaving, Elvis Presley. I'm leaving from Elvis Presley, the choice of Emer Reynolds, who's with me tonight in the studio. So Elvis dies in 77, Emer. Star Wars came out in 78. And you mentioned earlier Star Wars as being your first big cinema experience. For a lot of younger people listening to this, if there are any young people listening to this, you know, Star Wars is now something you can see on satellite television, you know, any night of the week, or you can watch it on DVD anytime you want or anything. It's very hard to describe what a big deal a movie like that was. Can you remember, did you just go along to it because it was another movie, or were you ready for it? Did you know this thing was coming?
All I knew about cinema, literally all I knew about cinema, and as I said, it involves the words Gary Glitter, which you know, is not allowed to be spoken anymore either. But my sister had gone to a Gary Glitter concert film about a year before in Kells in County Meath with my cousin, and was trying to describe it to me and my younger sisters, and we literally had no idea what she was talking about. She said that at one stage he threw flowers into the audience, and we were saying, "Did you catch them?" And she's like, "No, because it's a film." And we literally, I couldn't understand it in any way what it was. So when we were being brought to the Savoy to see Star Wars, I mean, I remember every detail of that day. I remember where we parked the car. I remember walking up Talbot Street and down O'Connell Street, which is a very different place now than it was then. Mm. I remember the seats we sat in, the hairs standing up on the back of my neck with the sound, the richness of the sound filling the entire cinema. And I was already a space fanatic. I was already a science fiction fanatic. And yet nothing had prepared me for... Even to this day, when I see the opening titles with the text crawling across the screen, you know, it's electric. And I just the idea now that children see so much, and even when they're 3 and 4, they're already at the cinema. That's amazing to me, you know, that they're so educated and so adept at it before they're even out of.
How would you become a space fanatic or a sci-fi fanatic already?
So. My space obsession basically happened as soon as we started going down to Moher in Tipperary, from having lived in Dublin with the blurry pale sky where you can barely see any stars, and rocking up on this dark sky farm in the middle of Tipperary and literally thousands of stars banging out every night. I became totally devoted to being an astronaut. I used to keep this little book with me where I wrote down everything I knew about the planets and the solar system and anything I learned. I literally had it with me 24 hours a day. And I used to go out at night and lie on the grass in the farm and hold on to the grass with my fingers, thinking I'm tumbling through, because I had all these facts and figures in my head about the speed the Earth was tumbling at and the speed we were flying through space. And I became really devoted to the idea of space and me getting to space and what was out there and aliens. And, you know, that was just a...
But that's not science fiction. That's science you're talking about.
Yeah. So my dad used to bring me to the library in Rohini every Wednesday night, and I started reading kind of early science fiction.
What did you read? Was it just whatever?
Really whatever. Yeah. I mean, I can't really remember the younger ones, but I do remember when I got a bit older, it was Asimov and Heinlein, and I loved Frederick Pohl, and I got very into Larry Niven, who's really like, it's just shoot 'em ups in space. It's just space cowboys and Indians. So I don't think I was very discerning, but I would have read anything. In fact, I'm still a little bit like that.
And what about the comics and the space kind of sci-fi kind of magazines and so on? My memory of those is that it was all boys.
Yeah, I didn't have anything like that. And I still don't. I don't connect with that comic book world at all.
Yeah. And there was a thing called Starburst or something like that. I think it was called. It was a mag. Now, there were a bunch of guys I knew, and I kind of affected an interest in it for about a month, but I couldn't take it seriously.
Yeah, even now, and we're talking about the Phil Lynott film, he was interested in comic books and Marvel comics and all that.
I love Marvel comics.
Yeah, but even when I'm talking about that idea, some little part of my brain keeps thinking, is it comics? Is it graphic novels? Yeah. I don't get it. I just don't connect into that idea, I don't think.
And was that anything to do with the fact that you were a girl as opposed to a boy? Because, as I say, I only knew boys to read this kind of stuff. Maybe there were girls reading it.
Yeah, no, I didn't know any girls reading it, no. Yeah. I think there are differences in being the experience of being a girl growing up and the experience of being a boy growing up. And yet, in some ways, my childhood life kind of blurred some of those distinctions, because it was a man raising 4 girls. And I'm not sure he was trying to raise us as boys. He absolutely wasn't. But we were all fixing punctures and changing plugs, and we were all mad into GAA and hurling and, you know, Dublin in the football and Tipperary in the hurling. And, you know, so when I look at the differences, where boys interested in some types of comics and some types of music and girls are interested in other stuff, it's very interesting to me. Where do we split, or where do we diverge in how we navigate our teenage years?
Interesting point. All right. Your next choice is Neil Young. Do you have a? Of course, you mentioned earlier, didn't you? He was one of the first that you really got into.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, and it's a little weird because it's very dual. My favorite album in my early teens, my favorite two albums, were Neil Young Harvest and Christa Berg Spanish Train. So, explain that to me. I don't think a boy would go for that kind of lack of logic, would they?
People forget how big Christa Berg was. Huge, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it was kind of unavoidable.
Yeah.
All those songs were sung at weddings. And
we went to every Christa Berg concert, like and myself and a group of kids.
Even school discos, yeah. You know.
But thankfully, Neil Young went out over Christa Berg. I'm not going to subject you to Spanish Train.
Do you have a particular... this track is from After the Gold Rush, but there are several Neil Youngs out there as well. I mean, there's...
I'm the pure play, all the acoustic, gentle stuff. You know, yeah. I saw him in the O2 a few years ago and he did like a 15-minute version of Keep On Rocking in the Free World and I nearly lost my head. I was exhausted with the noise of it.
He doesn't care. Here we go, birds. And that's Neil Young, Birds, from After the Gold Rush, one of the teenage obsessions of my guest tonight, Emma Reynolds, the Emmy Award-winning director.
You keep saying that.
It's great to be able to say that. Really, yes, I would say that. If it was me, I'd say it all. I'd put it on a T-shirt. Now, we were talking about Star Wars, and that was your first big experience at the cinema, and how excited you were going to it. When it was over, you walked out. You know, had your life been altered by that?
Yeah, and although I can't say that that was where I decided I wanted to become a filmmaker, that wasn't it at all. But I definitely came out of the cinema. I remember going to the cinema, and I remember coming home. I remember thinking, the universe now has completely, been reborn in a whole. My science fiction and space fanatic obsessions went up a few rungs.
Now, you see, if you were doing an interview now for Hollywood Reporter or something, you would have said, yes, my career, I went to see Star Wars.
I need
Wars.
To brush up on this.
I went to see Star Wars and I came out and that was it. I decided there and then I would be a filmmaker.
No, the film that made me want to become a filmmaker was 12 Angry Men.
Really?
Yeah.
That's one of the best movies ever made.
I joined a film club in school. Miss MacDonald, the English teacher, set up a film club between our school and the local boys' school, 15 of us and 15 of them. And it was an old 16mm projector and the first film they played was 12 Angry Men.
And what a great thing to happen at school.
It was fantastic. Yeah. And I remember literally thought the world had turned on its axis. I came home and I had a big row/debate with my dad about all the stuff that was in the film, not the filmmaking, you know, the ideas in the film, but racism, about justice, about how can we tell, you know, should we challenge our assumptions? And lying in bed that night thinking, wow, you know, because until that point, I wanted to be an astronaut/pilot, you know, like either would have been both. And then that night I ripped up that plan and decided to get into film.
Yeah.
Well, of course, as well, I was really bad at car sickness, so I thought I'd make a shocking astronaut.
I suppose a lot of people, a film like 12 Angry Men might well have been the first smart, intelligent film. A lot of films are intelligent, but the first one that left you thinking about other things afterwards.
Yeah. And it's too grand an idea, I know, but can film change the world, or can film really dive into these significant conversations that need to happen in the world? And they don't have to be documentaries. They don't have to be po-faced deconstructions. They can actually be stories that ask a question of an audience that will resonate in their mind for an hour or a week, a year, and talk to them on a very subliminal, profound level.
And did you know at the time that it was based on a play, or were you thinking about that as well?
I knew a little bit about that after, because after the part of the club was that you'd watch the film and then have a big discussion. So some of that stuff came out. And
no, the reason I ask is you didn't there and then decide, I'd like to be a writer or I'd like to be a playwright. But it was film that attracted you.
Yeah.
The fact it was on the screen.
No, and I knew nothing about film, literally. I had one cousin who was a cameraman in RTE. But he was much older than us, so I didn't know much about his work. But I knew nobody in film. I knew nobody working in arts in any way. So it wasn't like I came out of that meeting or that screening thinking, I'll be an editor, I'll be a director, I'll be in a cinema, even a writer. I had no understanding of what it might mean, apart from it was like a little beacon, it was like a little candle was lit.
Now, this, of course, we're not talking about the 19th century here.
No.
It's not that long ago. But back then, and it's not that long ago, but back then, you know, where do you go? I mean, it seems more possible nowadays, I think, to become a filmmaker or at least find out how to become one.
Absolutely, it does. And even when you look on Facebook or, you know, you're dicking around on the internet, you'll see David Fincher or Martin Scorsese or David Lynch giving, you know, you can sign up to a kind of a program that'll teach you about how to make a film, and they'll talk you through their process and show you shot lists and show you storyboards and show you how they work a script. Nothing like that existed. I don't think there were any books about it. There was certainly nothing in my library. You know, it was made up, you know, and I came from a position of even where would you even start? So there were film. This was 1984 when I left school. There was two film courses in Dublin, but they were very, very rarefied. And you know.
So what did you do? You studied maths and science, yeah?
Yeah. So I went into Trinity. Literally, the plan was that I would start. I would do. You know, my dad, as well as all his other great qualities, was a little bit of a slob in that, and he thought, he definitely influenced me into thinking you needed a proper degree, you know, a real science degree, as opposed to, you know, faffing around in film. But my plan, such as there was one, was to go into college and try and get involved in film somehow. There must be a film society or an arts club or something, and just do a proper degree. So I got involved with the Film Society in Trinity, and they were making a short film. In fact, directed by somebody I think you've had in here before, Alan Gilson, and who went on to become a friend of mine and a collaborator of mine. And Anne Enright, the Booker winner, she was the lead actress in it. So that was my first taste. I was just the gopher. I was carrying the film cans and getting coffees for everybody. And it was my first taste of, I had no idea what anyone was doing. I had no idea what was actually happening. But it was being edited by a man called Martin Duffy, who was an editor in RTE.
Yeah.
And from the minute, and literally the day and hour, he invited us all in. We were all just young students. I went in to the cutting room to see what he was doing. And from the minute I went into that room and I saw, you know, one shot being joined to another shot, I thought, actually, this is something I can get, you know, editing. I thought there was extraordinary power and alchemy and creativity just in this very basic idea, you know, that ripples in a pond, or that one shot beside another means something that it didn't mean before. So then I had a goal. Then I was able to focus on I'd become an editor if I could.
And what about the maths and science and the degree?
Yeah, so it's because my story sounds like a very sad story. It's not really. We had a very happy childhood, but my dad sadly passed away a few months into my first year in Trinity, and the wheels came off a little. We were suddenly orphaned. We were all still in school. We were all in college. My younger sister was still in school. So the wheels came off my life a little, and you know, my college career started wavering. And Martin Duffy took me on as a trainee assistant editor. He went freelance around the same time. So I was unlucky and lucky.
Yeah.
I found my way into film, in some ways through, you know, unhappy events. But you know, maybe my life would have gone that path anyway somehow. So I was lucky to get trained up in that way.
It's kind of extraordinary the way things work out, don't they, for people? Yeah, when you think about it. Because again, you know, I so many guests we've had on the programme, their jobs are, on the face of it, strange or odd or unachievable. But somehow they just end up doing what the thing that they wanted to do.
Yeah, and it's
one way or another.
I wonder. Yeah, I don't know if it's kind of fate or it's in the post for you. But my tutor from the physics department, Dr. Eric Finch, introduced me at an event a few weeks ago, and he told the story about remembering the young me coming in and saying, "I'm leaving college. I'm going to work in film editing." And he said it was like me saying I wanted to go and join the circus.
Yeah.
You know, I was supposed to be an astrophysicist, and now I was suddenly going off to join to become a film editor. And he was very worried for me. And then he said, then when he saw The Farthest in The Lighthouse, he suddenly thought, oh, OK, so, you know, all pieces of our lives find a way somehow to make sense.
Well, we'll talk about The Farthest after your next musical choice. I see you you got into prog rock and what do you call it, fusion.
Speaking of strange journeys.
Yeah, Weather Report. Yeah, where'd you find Weather Report?
We can blame, I made a friend called Liam Grant, who was slightly older than me and played a bass guitar. He was in a play I was in school, and I thought he was really cool. And he was into Weather Report and Pink Floyd and basically kind of all types of jazz. So he turned me on to that, and it was the beginning of a lifelong, it definitely rerouted me away from Neil Young and into that way of thinking,
okay,
way of listening.
This is Birdland from Weather Report. Weather Report, the choice of Emma Reynolds, Weather Report and Birdland. So you went through this big jazz fusion phase, which is kind of could be alarming. Were you really into it?
I was really. I'm kind of still really into it. You know, like I'm very if that's what I'm reaching for of an evening just to relax.
Really, Weather Report.
Well, yeah, and anything in that. But I mean, I branched out of that came Keith Jarrett and as a Miles Davis, and you know, like it led me down a massive path of jazz. I think really ultimately. So, I just love that. That sends me right back to.
And this was just a fella you knew when you were in your teens.
I think that's a part of the story of music, though, isn't it? For everybody, that different people enter your life and bring different influences with them. And I think as an editor in particular, it's different now as a director, but as an editor, I was always being exposed to different people would bring different music into the cutting room that they were using to inspire different ways of looking at films. So, I was always very open to all, you know, soaking up all that new stuff.
Did he make you a mixtape, did he?
Oh, yeah. Mixtapes is part of the world, wasn't it?
It was a fine art, that, wasn't it?
And how to kind of get them to blend into each other. Yeah. And not have a big clunk of a breaking your thumbs trying to...
Or a DJ's voice. You know, some Mark Cagney or somebody talking over the top.
Oh, I don't think I ever had that.
Not that. No objections to Mark Cagney whatsoever. He introduced me to a lot of great music, but you didn't want the DJ on the mixtape.
No, you had to try to edit that out.
Yeah.
That was fine timing required, wasn't it, to press the two recorders at the same time?
And did your friend design a cover for it and everything?
Yeah. So that's part of the art.
Terrific. Young people today.
They don't even know what we're talking
about. No, they don't. But fortunately, none of them are listening. No. Steely Dan. I'm just going to play one more in this territory and then we'll take a break and then we'll talk about The Farthest after that. Steely Dan kind of, even though they're ostensibly a rock group, they're kind of in that same kind of bracket in my mind.
Yeah. They're all, I lumped them all together and I wouldn't even know how to describe them all in different subgenres. You know, Steely Dan is straight from Weather Report to Steely Dan to Pink Floyd is just one straight line for me.
Thing is, a lot of people, you know, slag off Steely Dan. And if you ask me, did I like Steely Dan, I'd probably say, not much. But then every so often, I have this awful hankering to hear the sort of the clarity of a Steely Dan record, you know? There's something really clear and, you know, refreshing.
Gosh, I would never put the words clear and refreshing with Steely Dan. But
just sonically, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know what they're talking about.
Did they?
I never know. I don't pay any attention to that. No, but what I'm saying is there's a certain kind of music that I don't really think I'm into anymore. Yeah. And then I hear it and I think, great.
Yeah.
I mean, I was in a record shop in Maherfelt the other day and I thought, I must buy something. And I bought Tom Petty's Greatest Hits.
Yeah.
And it's probably years since I listened to Tom Petty, but I was really in the mood to hear that, just that kind of music.
Yeah.
So let's hear Steely Dan. Which track do you want?
Babylon Sisters.
Steely Dan, the choice of Emma Reynolds, the director who's with me tonight in studio picking all the tracks. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more. Particularly, I want to talk about the film The Farthest and all the other work that Emma's working on currently. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special where we get someone in to pick the music. And tonight it's Emer Reynolds. Emer's a director, film editor, Emmy Award winner and all the rest of it. And we've been talking about her life in Dublin and in Tipperary, her musical influences, her interest in mathematics and space, wanting to be an astronaut and a pilot, but instead going out down the route of film editing and working in the film business. Emer, I want to talk about The Farthest, but just before we get there, it wasn't the first thing you did. Couldn't have been. Or was it?
No, it was my second feature to direct, but my first feature to direct solo. I had directed one, I'd co-directed one just before it. In fact, completely different subject, a feature film called Here Was Cuba, which I co-directed with John Murray, which was about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
So this, The Farthest was my second, but my first solo.
And when did you start thinking, right, I've got this idea of my own that I want to turn into a documentary feature?
So that was after we finished Here Was Cuba, which we John and I loved doing together. We discussed making another film together with me as a solo director, him as a producer, and he was one of the two producers on The Farthest. And space was an absolute natural fit for both of us. Both of us were quite obsessed with space and actually both pretty obsessed with Voyager, which had never got an outing on a cinema screen. It had been made into many fine TV documentaries, but it had never given the kind of the epic treatment on a cinema screen. So it was coming up to an anniversary to do with the launch of the spacecraft. So we started trying to see if there would be an appetite for a feature film that would go into the cinema that would tell this epic space adventure. And there was. And we went from there.
And was it hard to get, not the making of it, but to get it made and to get it funded? Because I know people in your line of work and they're tormented years and years and years trying to get money for this and money for that. And I don't know how they do it. I really don't.
If I say it was easy to get it up and running, John would be laughing or choking up his coffee. You know, it took us about 2 years to get the funds together. John's an extraordinary and experienced and very persuasive producer and has an awful lot of wonderful connections and a massive track record. And so he worked very hard at putting together the package because we knew it was going to be an expensive film because there was an awful lot of CGI, computer-generated imagery of space in it. And the idea for the film was very ambitious, very visually ambitious, you know, to tell a story that would survive on the cinema screen.
So what was the pitch?
We, you know, literally talked about it as a cinema adventure story with big epic visuals. It wasn't just going to stick to the facts, you know, that this was the date we left. We discovered that at Jupiter, that it was going to be a big human story with heart and with ambition and with, you know, about intelligence and all the things that we might discover about ourselves. So the great thing about the spacecraft, the great thing about the Voyager spacecraft is that it has this little golden record disc on the spacecraft. So the spacecraft itself is out there investigating the four outer planets that had never been looked at before, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. So this is going to be a first time, first spacecraft ever doing that. So that in itself is extraordinary. It's a brilliant story of science and curiosity and invention. And then it has this little record on it, which was a story about...
And in case anybody listening doesn't know what we're talking about, it's an actual record.
It's an actual gold-plated LP stuck to the side of the record, to the spacecraft. And it was an attempt by the famous scientist Carl Sagan and his very small team to communicate with extraterrestrials were we to ever encounter any. So they put on this, on the golden record, music and sound, a beautiful sound essay with rain and children's cries and dogs barking and greetings from Earth and photos of life on Earth.
Chuck Berry.
Yeah, and Chuck Berry, to communicate to aliens, were they ever to discover it? So the spacecraft and the golden record together gave, and this was certainly from my childhood in terms of all my interests, you know, of literature and science. It gives you this particular spacecraft gives you a chance to explore science and scientific endeavor and curiosity, but actually gives you a chance to look at art and music and love and hope and aliens and philosophy. Why are we here? What's it all for? What's out there? How will it all end? So that was the pitch, that this particular spacecraft gives us a chance to tell a very big, heart-filled story about humans and about what it means to be alive. So it's more than a film about space. It's a film about, you know, the mysteries of being human.
And this was your first outing as a solo director. Mm. And I'm just going to read some of this out now. apart from Emmy Award winning director. Let me see where we could start with all this. Well, it won the Emmy for Outstanding Science and Technology Documentary. Right, this was 2018. Best Feature Documentary at the Irish Film and TV Awards. The US National Academy of Sciences Communication Award. And then there are TV versions of it that have been shown all over the world as well. Now, awards ceremonies, you know, an awful lot of nonsense about awards and one thing and another. But when you're winning awards from scientific foundations for a film like that, that must be very gratifying. Because it means what you've done is useful.
Yeah, and you know, we were a huge amount of heart and soul and endeavour and talent went into the film. So when it then communicates, you know, when people reach it and they respond to it, it really does make you feel like you actually achieved a huge amount. And to feel that the National Academy of Sciences, for example, responding to it and saying that you're actually talking in a way that will help children understand science, understand space and scientific method, you know, it's very, very rewarding because it's such a hard thing to make a film, but to make something that touches people and communicates is a great honour.
How important, now we know how important your interest in space would have been to this, but how important was your interest in mathematics and so on? Because I don't know how far you took maths. Did you take maths into the territory of, you know, bending universes and, you know, string theory and all that kind of stuff? Are you au fait with all of that stuff?
I'd read that kind of popular science stuff, you know, just for fun now.
Is that popular now?
I wouldn't be reading like the massive textbooks.
Well, you know, quantum physics and all that.
Yeah, kind of stuff, I would like all that. So I have an interest in all that and I'd have a layman's grasp on it, you know, like I would understand Stephen Hawking when he writes in the popular science book type of way, you know. So, yeah, the film, I think, had a desire to make some of that accessible.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted to not just speak to space and science geeks, you know, like myself, who'd be all over all the little minutiae about what sort of chemicals were found on the surface of Titan, you know, but actually to talk to a broad audience who might be lit up by the adventure. And yeah, so I don't know how much, I mean, every film comes through you and, you know, but also comes through all your key creatives. And so pieces of us all end up in the film. And definitely my great love of science, my great love of maths, I think is in the film.
And tell me a little bit about directing a film like that, which is not directing actors, you know, it's not directing a story as such. I mean, there is a story, but what I mean is it's not a bank robbery.
Yeah. You're some part of the process is to figure out how the story might get told. So, for example, in the case of The Farthest with the Voyager spacecraft, it had been out in space for 40 years. There was no footage of it. So we had to dream up a way to tell this story, this 40-year span of story, and dream up the imagery and the way we might couch that story. So we built it on certain foundations, and one of them was the people that were at the centre of the story. So to actually pull in as many people who were central to the Voyager spacecraft building and the Golden Record and actually build our film around them. And that was built on the idea that it's a human experience, you know, that maths and science can be intimidating, but human people are in there dreaming it up and investing their life's work in it. So to really talk to their humanity and their experience. So that was one pillar that we built it on. And all you've got to go on is your instinct. And my instinct was I wanted to make a film about space and a film about science that would reflect how I felt about it. You know, that it wasn't numbers and facts, that it was about awe, it was about beauty, it was about hope, it was about some spiritual questioning of what's it all for. And if trusting, and as I said, the characters, the humans at the centre of the story, and then kind of hoofing and hoping, really, you know, putting all these balls in play, following your nose and dreaming up the imagery and the CGI and all these things, and then trying to weave them together into a story where you keep your big lights very close to you. And our big lights were honesty and humour and heart, you know, keeping these ideas very close and always pushing the film through that gate, you know, pushing it through the lens of that, you know, does it communicate? Will it reach, you know, a 9-year-old girl in Dublin, you know, an 85
year old
woman.
Imagine if you'd seen that when you were nine.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, one person said to me,
you probably would be an astronaut by now, actually.
Notwithstanding the car sickness.
You've picked a piece of music as well, I see, from The Farthest.
Yeah.
Archer Pruitt.
Yeah, and this is actually this piece of music was very central to the making of the film, because I heard this piece of music driving home from Belfast after a bad breakup, and a friend of mine, Carol Moorhead, who I think you know, gave me a compilation album called Love Songs, Lament and 21st Century Heartbreak. And it was a whole...
Not necessarily a wise move.
And it was Ron Sexsmith, and you know, it had a lot of great people on it, and this song was on it. And I remember thinking, If I ever get to make that space film, I'm going to have this Archer Pruitt song on it.
The Race. Archer Pruitt and a song, The Race, the choice of Emma Reynolds, who's with me in studio tonight, picking all the music. And we were just talking about The Farthest there, and making a documentary like that, feature documentary. And it's important to draw that distinction, I guess. People see documentaries on television and they might last half an hour, and maybe they're not documentaries at all. They're just maybe an interview with someone, an intercut with video or something like that. But a feature documentary is a big thing. It's a big deal. And can you explain to me, you know, what the power of it potentially is, and why you're committed to feature documentary like this when you could be directing or editing more, you know, a straightforward movie? Possibly it might be easier to do that, I don't know, or easier to get them made or whatever.
Yeah, well, and as I said, I'm hoping to do some regular straightforward directing of drama next year. I'm developing a few projects, but I love feature documentaries. And what is it? They have a power. You know, the difference between them and a TV documentary, or as you say, a political investigation or whatever, they're actually trying to work on a different level of communication, of, you know, of engaging with you. So it's not just going to be, they won't fly in the cinema if they are just unfurling fact after fact or positions, or, you know, even, you know, current affairs won't work in the cinema because it'll take you 2 years to make it and that moment in time will be gone. So there's no immediacy to them, really. They are long term. In fact, for The Farthest, it took us 4 years from script to screen, you know. So they're these big, long love affair adventures where the filmmakers are really going to be embedded in this story for a long time. And what they have at their heart is real life. You know, nothing more exciting than the real person who on The Farthest interview the people who literally sat in a room saying, what does this spacecraft look like? How do we make it fly past Jupiter? How do we make it fly past Neptune? I mean, that's so exciting, just to be close to that flame, you know. When we made Here Was Cuba, the people that had averted humankind's darkest hour, you know, the most dangerous 13 days when we nearly destroyed ourselves in nuclear annihilation on the Phil Lynott film. You know, it's about talking to people who knew him, who experienced him, you know. So you're actually, for the filmmaker, it's a real adventure in, and an education in, getting close to a subject. And then,
so therefore you're not going to undertake a documentary feature, excuse me, unless you really care about it yourself.
Absolutely. And you'd be a fool too if you were to think, oh, I'll just knock this off, because you're not going to be able to. It's going to be a much longer adventure and you really need to be able to give it a lot of your life.
But it has to come from you though, doesn't it?
Yeah, it has to be something you care for. And I think you'll feel that when you watch a great feature documentary, you'll see the commitment of the filmmaker, you'll see the commitment of all the team, you'll see a voice, and you know, they're rarely pieces of work that haven't got a particular identity, a particular thing to say, you know. And you're really, it's not spin, it's not about being pulled around to a way of seeing the world, it's genuine engagement with an idea and a desire to explore it on a profoundly aesthetic, emotional, intellectual level.
I think a lot of people, though, and myself included, I didn't grow up going to see documentary features. I don't think I ever saw one in the cinema until relatively recently, I guess. But with Netflix and everything else, that seems to have changed, isn't it? I mean, people are now actively seeking out documentary features.
Yeah, I probably got my years wrong, but about 5 years ago, it suddenly started to be a thing that films that were not dramas, you know, the film documentaries would be in the cinema and people might go to see them. I remember seeing Capturing the Freedmans and, you know, it was a huge hit. And people were, ordinary people in London and Dublin were just going along to the cinema to see it. You know, so there was a shift and there was a sudden understanding that documentary can punch in that arena, you know, and really have an impact on you.
And given the fact that so many movies, you know, you see them and they don't really change your life very much. They might entertain you. It might not.
Yeah.
But a documentary feature usually has an effect on you, doesn't it? I mean, even if it's about something you know nothing about.
And that, I think that's the thing I said about real life. You know, you really feel close to something that's authentic. And when you see, like, for example, I think my favourite film of the last 5 years is a documentary, Fire at Sea, which is about the refugee centre on Lampedusa. You know, like, but that's a film that would wake me up in the middle of the night every 2 or 3 months, you know, with my heart pounding, thinking, the feeling of, and it's not just the facts in the film. These are the thousands of refugees that landed and got looked after by this or processed by this refugee centre. It's the feeling of the waves crashing on the shore. It's the feeling of how the filmmaker drew you into the experience of being lost and alone at sea and at the mercy of the waves and at the mercy of world governments indifferent to your plight, you know. So, and did it affect me? Yeah, I you know, you suddenly turn on to the plight of refugees more.
You've got time to tell your story as well. That's the other part of it, isn't it? It's longer.
Yeah.
It's an obvious thing to point out, but if you've got 25 minutes on RTE to tell that story, it's not the same, is it?
That's right. You're going at some lick.
Mm. Your next musical choice, Lucinda Williams, I see, is on your list. This is a great list. Lucinda Williams, Those 3 Days.
Yeah, this is what I was saying earlier about, you know, when you're an editor, you meet different filmmakers who bring in different types of music into your life that you weren't quite, you know, prepared for or you had no idea of. So I as an assistant editor, I spent a year in Belfast working with the filmmaker John T. Davis on a beautiful film called Hobo. And all my friends in Belfast were mad into...
Tell us about John, anybody doesn't know him.
He's a brilliant...
An actual cowboy.
Yeah, an actual cowboy. And up there with him and with Shane Mary Doyle, the editor, I was suddenly plunged into a world of country music.
And that Hobo was a great film, isn't
fantastic
it?
Film. And suddenly I was turned on to Hank Williams and Woody Guthrie and Doug Stone and Steve Earle and Lucinda Williams. You know, there was suddenly this flood of cool country music into my life where none had previously existed. So that's where this love comes from.
Okay, Lucinda Williams. And that's Lucinda Williams there, Those 3 Days, from the album World Without Tears. The choice of Emma Reynolds, who's with me in studio tonight, picking the music. Emma, you mentioned that there are plans for drama as well as feature documentary. Tell me about Potashnik, or as much as you can tell me about it at this stage.
Yeah, well, Potashnik is a very exciting science fiction film that I'm working on with Samson Films, with a young, very talented producer, and in fact a director in her own right, Rina Gnigriagor, and a Dublin writer called Gavin Burke, who came up with the idea for this extraordinary kind of space opera film.
Well, isn't it great that
set in deep space?
There are people out there wanting to make science fiction films in Dublin.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. And Gavin, you know, he was writing this script, had this idea for this story, and, you know, couldn't kind of conceive of how you would make it in Ireland, you know, couldn't imagine how, was there anyone in Ireland or in the film business in Dublin who would have, you know, any interest in it. And then when he says that when he saw The Farthest, admittedly a documentary, but clearly showing a great love of science fiction and space, he contacted me and said, would I be interested in reading it and talking with him about developing it? So myself, himself and Rinak have been developing it ever since. And it's a very exciting project. We were over in Bulgaria at, you know, a funding meeting a couple of weeks ago, and there's a lot of excitement around the film. It's and this Biosphere album, Substrata, was part of the influence it influenced how Gavin came up with the idea and how he's developing the story, and it's been influencing how
I'm... So music is part of...
It's part of how we're conceiving of the tone of the film, and you'll hear from in the centre. This is a very ambient piece of music, and it's got a lot of, which I love, kind of sound effects and kind of deconstructed kind of sounds within it. But then there's this kind of weird... And in fact, I don't know if he's a cosmonaut, but that's what he sounds like, this Russian voice, that's disembodied, strange Russian voice, and this kind of analog recording mixed in with the ideas. So it's this piece of music is influencing how we plan to tell this story of this woman alone and lost in space.
And how close are you to getting this made? I mean,
we're moving on to our second draft. Our first draft, Gavin's first draft, was extremely strong and invited a lot of interest in the story. And it's an extremely dynamic role for a young female lead. So there's a lot of interest in the film in terms of what its potential. So we're moving to second draft now and hoping to, you know, that will accelerate the process, hope to
and
maybe make it next year. But you never know in films. So this, we could be sitting here in 2 years and it hasn't happened, or we could be, you know, rushing into a studio next year. So hopefully the latter.
OK, well, here's the music that's informing the thing. That's Biosphere. Cobrezia from Substrata, which is currently inspiring work from our guest tonight, Emma Reynolds, Potashnik. And hopefully in a few years' time we'll see Potashnik.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. We have a whole lot of time left, but I want to make sure that you get at least this one in and a couple more. But you want to play one for your husband, so we're going to have to play that. We absolutely have to. So it's Minnie Riperton, is that right?
It's yeah, Minnie Riperton. The rest of them all been so sad, but this is so joyous, and this was... Yeah, we played this as the first song at our wedding.
Don't try this at home. Singing it, I mean. Minnie Riperton there. Sorry, we were having a conversation there during Minnie Riperton and Loving You. It's a mad, wonderful thing, that song, isn't it?
It's so joyous.
With Tweety Birds on it and everything.
Yeah, and really very suited to my husband, Tony, who's...
Would he agree with that?
He's full of me. He brings birdies into my life. He's in many ways he saved my life. He's a beautiful person and a co-collaborator. He edited The Farthest, amazing editor, and he's also editing my Phil Lynott documentary for me right now. He's slaving at an Avid while I'm in here.
That notoriously doesn't work, does it? People who live together and work together.
Yeah, so they say, but we're proving them wrong. It's been very fruitful, and it's not without its, you know, some bumps along the way, but really, really loving working with him.
Ah, isn't that nice? What's his name?
Tony Cranston.
Good man, Tony. Let's talk about the Philip Lynott documentary upcoming. And as I said at the top of the programme, just by way of full disclosure, you interviewed me for that and that's where we met. And I thought I'd invite you onto this because I could tell you liked your music, and you loved your music and you love what you do. Have you got a title for it yet?
Yeah, it's called, right now it's called Songs for While I'm Away, which was the name of one of his books of poetry and a song that he wrote. Whether that title will stay, I hope it will, because I think it really talks to the tone of the film, you know, that it's a softer film about the man, the poet, behind the big noisy tracks that you probably associate with Phil Lynott.
Yeah. Now, again, when you were talking about The Farthest, you had this obsession with space from when you were a child, holding on to the grass in the dark in Tipperary, looking at the stars. What was your relationship with the idea of Philip Lynott that made you want to make this film, given that there are documentaries out there and this, you know, you can see them on YouTube anytime you want, but this again, like all these documentary features, it has come from you.
Well, I was introduced to Thin Lizzy. Myself and my sister had two boyfriends when we were 15, 16 who were Thin Lizzy nuts. She went and married her one. I didn't. And in fact, my brother-in-law Steve's was such a Lizzy obsessive that they, at their wedding, they had a Thin Lizzy tribute band as the wedding band, which is pretty extraordinary. Great for the dancing. So, you know, I loved Lizzy at that time. And, you know, although I came to it quite late, I kind of started listening to it probably, potentially or arguably, as Thin Lizzy were kind of on their on the downward slide, you know, but I did go to the very last two Thin Lizzy gigs in Dublin in the RDS in 1983 mm-hmm. and cried the whole way through them, you know. But
and what was it about Philip that attracted you then and still attracts you to the extent that you want to devote all this time and energy into making a documentary feature?
Well, in truth, I was approached about this film by the producer, Alan Marr, who was exploring making a film about about Phil Lynott, and approached me to see would I be interested after having seen The Farthest. So this wasn't generated by me, but, you know, I jumped onto it like a drowning man on a life raft, because I always adored Phil Lynott in terms of, you know, his look, the sound of his voice, what he was singing about, the sex appeal, the confidence, you know. I as I said, I remember standing in the RDS crying onto my then boyfriend's leather jacket, you know, just thinking we'll never see his like again. And in fact, we had never seen his like before that. You know, he really he embodied everything that made me feel that you could be something in your life were you to dream it up. You know, he comes out of this working class, underprivileged childhood in Crumlin. And there he is becoming the first, this hugely iconic Irish rock star in a time when we weren't flooded with them, you know. So
if I remember correctly, you and I got tied up in knots during the interview when we were talking about the sort of the macho thing. And, you know, we live in a different era now where men are mercifully more aware of what they're doing and what they're saying, or ought to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And we ended up talking about that, and I don't know where we ended up.
I agreed with where you ended up, which is where I do agree with you that in some ways there was a cartoonish element to it. You know, there was a wink and a nod. He knew what he was doing. They knew what they were doing, which was playing to that uber masculine heavy metal. You know, using the guitar in a kind of a phallic way. But I think there was comedy to it. There was a knowingness to it, and you can't see anything other than that when you see the performance and when you see the other songs. You know, the depth of the poetry, the depth of the writing, both lyrically and musically. You know, it isn't a one note, as I said, big rock bombast kind of note. You know, it's got a lot of subtlety to it.
And you're very drawn, as I am actually, to the, well, popular makes sounds like you're diminishing this stuff, but those songs that are really good pop songs, actually. Yeah. Those swinging songs. That
yeah,
Lizzie
Running
did,
Back you know? Is one of my favourites, and it's little known.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we've similar interest in what Lizzie songs we like.
And I'm hoping that if the film, you know, hopefully it will work and communicate and reach, but I would love it for people to be coming out of the cinema going, well, I knew all the big giant hits like Jailbreak and The Boys Are Back in Town and, in fact, Dancing in the Moonlight, which is one of the softer, more popular ones. But that they'll go, oh, wow, I didn't know that he had written such beautiful little ballads, such subtle songs, such, you know, sneaky ones that there's room for them in the film, where you'll understand that there's a lot more to this man than you probably thought you knew.
And I don't want to talk too much about the film and how you're going to do it, but, you know, That's a story that ends badly. How do you deal with that?
Yeah.
Or how do you approach that? I'm not asking you how you're doing it in the film, but how do you think about that in advance?
I think the story of his death and the sad ending to his life, I think, is well known. And we don't intend to not incorporate that in the film and reflect on it. But actually, the film's desire is much more to celebrate the man, the life, the career, the achievement, you know, to actually track a young boy brought by his mother at age 7 to live with his grandmother because she couldn't take care of him, you know, a lone mother in Manchester, all the way to, you know, playing in front of the Sydney Opera House in front of 100,000 screaming fans. There's much more to his story than the sad death and unfortunately succumbing to addictions. So we're much more interested in celebrating him, taking a tender look at his life, than we are, you know, poring over the unfortunate and unhappy details of his death.
Yeah. And where are you at with it now?
We've just started editing with Tony Cranston. My husband is editing for me, and we've only started 4 weeks into the edit. So we'll hopefully have it finished by the end of the summer. That's certainly our hope. Philip would have been 70 this August. Can you believe 70? Wow. So I don't think we'll be quite finished by then, but we'll hopefully be finished towards the end of the year and hopefully getting it into the cinemas then.
It's going to be great to hear that music at volume again too.
In a cinema setting. Yeah.
Okay, what Lizzie song have you picked for tonight?
I picked songs for While I'm Away.
See, a lot of people won't know this.
No, they won't. I don't think so.
Beautiful. A song for While I'm Away. Emma Reynolds chose that because that is going to be the title of her documentary feature on Philip Lynott. It's going to be extraordinary. I'm really looking forward to that. And if I didn't say it earlier, check out The Farthest as well. It's not on Netflix, though, is it? The Farthest?
It's on iTunes and iTunes, Amazon. Okay. And
but you should watch it, all right. Not on your phone.
Absolutely not.
but watch it properly.
In Savoy One, if you can.
In Savoy One would be ideal. So that's, I think we've already said, Emer, what the plan is going to be. You're working on Potashnik, trying to get that one over the line. And then, so this Philip Lynott one could be when?
Hopefully it will be finished around September, October and you know, getting it into the cinemas early next year, hopefully.
Can't wait to see it. And as I said earlier, I can't wait to be in a cinema and hear the music at volume.
Yeah.
Because it's
blowing your hair back.
It's a long time since I heard it at volume. In fact, you were there those last nights in the RDS. So, Emer, I want to thank you for coming in tonight.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Yeah, thanks, and very generous with your time and your insights and everything you've done. And thanks for picking these fine tracks. We had to drop a couple. It's a shame we ran out of time. I would like to have heard Bowie and Patti Smith and Brad Meldow and all that, but we got through the most of them.
We did.
Emer, your last choice is a soundtrack to a movie that some people may have seen called Blade Runner. It's still good, isn't it?
Never bettered. I just love this soundtrack.
Why does Blade Runner, do you think, work? I mean, it's a film. I'm not a total sci-fi fanatic. I love Star Trek and the rest of it, same as everybody else. But something about Blade Runner, you feel you're just settling into another world for a while. It really completely transports you away. But sometimes that's really what you need from a movie, isn't it?
Yeah. When you think of, I mean, now it's kind of old hat, but when I remember seeing it, I don't know, it's the early 80s or whenever it was, and the opening shots sweeping in over the city with puffs of flame out of these, and then they end up in the city and it's all rain and everyone's Asian. And, you know, they created this dystopian human future that was so believable and so gritty. It had never been done before. And then they have this kind of, they're cross-pollinating with kind of like private detective stories. Yeah. And, you know, so they're really, and then not being afraid to have the alien, the beautiful speech with the rain falling about, I've been out past the rings of Orion. And
Seen things, you people.
It ticks all the boxes. It's so heartfelt and ambitious.
If it was on, if you went home tonight and it's on television, would you find yourself, because I know I would, watching it again. I'm quite happy to dwell in that film.
I would watch it, every 6 months if I could. Although I watched it with my niece who's 22 now. And she found it kind of slow and I was heartbroken. I was like, oh, really? Does it not hold up? But it certainly does for me.
Emer, thanks a million. And we're going to leave you tonight, folks, with your last choice, Emer's last choice, which is the love theme from Blade Runner. Emer Reynolds, thanks a million.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.